Hi, this is Meredith Irvine, editor of thecorporatecouncil.net. Welcome to today's edition of our Timely Takes podcast. If you follow the thecorporatecouncil.net blog, hopefully you already know that there were three enforcement actions during the SEC's fiscal 2023 year-end enforcement push that involved allegations relating to Rule 21F17. In these and in prior enforcement actions, the SEC took issue with provisions in separation or employment agreements that it believed discouraged potential whistleblowers from voluntarily contacting the SEC about securities law violations. These settlements brought the running total of these types of enforcement actions to 21 since 2015. And after that first wave of enforcement actions in 2015, many companies took action to clarify that these provisions shouldn't be construed to prevent whistleblower claims. But the SEC has taken the position that some companies' attempted fixes weren't sufficient, and some of these problematic provisions continue to linger in forms. So there's been a renewed focus on this following this most recent enforcement push, and companies are considering internal compliance audits and/or going back and revisiting their forms, which certainly seems prudent at this point. So with me today to discuss 10 tips for drafting or revising agreements so they're compliant with Rule 21F17 are Sherry Adler and Mary Weeks of Troutman Pepper. Sherry is an executive compensation partner in Troutman Pepper's Philadelphia office, and Mary is a litigation partner in the firm's Atlanta and New York offices. They recently collaborated on a webinar and client alert on this topic, so I'm so happy they're here to share their drafting tips. Welcome, Sherry and Mary. Thanks for taking the time to be here today. So before we kick off on the substance, can you both share with our listeners a little bit about your background?
Sure. Hi, Meredith. This is Sherry Adler. Thank you so much for having us here today. We're excited to be talking with you about this topic. My practice focuses on all aspects of executive compensation, especially for public companies. So I advise companies on cash and equity incentive arrangements and related SEC disclosures. I also advise on the executive compensation and employee benefits aspects of M&A transactions. I'm particularly excited to be joined by Mary Weeks today because our collaboration is really the product of an internal group I co-founded at the firm several years ago that brings together transactional lawyers like myself and litigators like Mary to provide our clients with cutting-edge advice that reflects the input of a diverse group of practitioners within our firm, often in the public company space.
Thanks, Sherry. And hi, this is Mary Weeks. I'm glad to be here as well, Meredith. So a little background on me. At Troutman Pepper, I co-lead the firm's securities, corporate governance, and D&O defense litigation group. And my practice is primarily in the areas of securities litigation, SEC enforcement, and government investigations more generally.
Perfect. Thank you so much again for being here today. So before we actually get into the topic of drafting compliant agreements, can you give us a little background here on the SEC's enforcement history?
Sure. So to set the stage, in 2011, the SEC prescribed rules relating to whistleblower activity under Section 21F of the Dodd-Frank Act. Rule 21F17A, we'll just call it the rule for today, said that no one can take any action to impede a potential whistleblower from coming forward, including by restricting disclosures under a confidentiality agreement. Now, there are certain exceptions for maintaining confidentiality of information obtained through communication subject to an attorney-client privilege or other privilege. So in terms of enforcement of the rule, the SEC has pursued violations through enforcement proceedings. And the way that we see those primarily are reflected in cease and desist orders, which are publicly filed. But these are essentially settlement agreements between the SEC, the companies under investigation. So as you mentioned, we have evidence of at least 21 such enforcement actions that have been brought since 2015. These can arise either as the impetus for an SEC investigation in and of themselves, whether that comes in via a tipster or review of the company's public disclosures more generally. And then it can also be a tag-along claim, where in those instances, the SEC would already be investigating a company. And then while they're there looking under the hood, they catch a potential violation of this rule as well. And we've seen some of these penalties be staggering. So civil penalties are likely to be lower if it's just a documentary violation. We see those in terms of $130,000 to the $400,000 range in the cases we looked at, but they can also be much higher. And that's especially where wrongdoing is actually identified. It's not just a documentary issue. And for those, the numbers we saw were anywhere from 1.4 million to as great as 10 million. Alongside enforcement activity related to the rule, I also wanted to mention that the SEC whistleblower program itself has been quite active, with evidence of the SEC recovering large amounts of money from companies due to violations of securities laws that came to the SEC's attention through whistleblower reporting, whether that was in whole or in part. So under the program, whistleblowers can receive awards between 10 to 30% of any funds collected by the SEC from companies if they bring an enforcement action that results in a monetary penalty over $1 million. So just as an example, in 2023, the SEC issued whistleblower awards that totaled nearly $600 million and the most ever awarded in 1 year, which here was a record-breaking $279 million awarded to a single whistleblower, according to a recent press release from the SEC.
Yes, some of those whistleblower awards have been staggering. It's amazing.
Yeah.
So let's jump right into drafting tips. First, we know that employee confidentiality agreements should contain a whistleblower carve-out, but some companies have attempted to include problematic conditions or limitations on these carve-outs. Can you describe those?
Sure. This is Sherry Meredith. I'll take that one. As to tip one, when an agreement has a standard provision stating that the employee cannot disclose confidential information, it should also have a carve-out saying that, notwithstanding the confidentiality provision, the employee is not restricted from reporting possible violations of securities law to governmental agencies in accordance with whistleblower protection laws. And you want to make sure to state in the carve-out that the employee does not need to seek prior approval from the company or its legal department before reporting the whistleblower claim. And it also doesn't need to notify the company after the fact. Where companies have gotten into trouble, even where they've had a provision that allowed the reporting of potential securities law violations to the SEC, is where they've also required that the employee first seek permission from the company or required that the employee notify the company after a report is made. And this required notice is seen by the SEC as having a chilling effect on an employee who might think twice about coming forward to the SEC if they need to notify their employer before or after doing so. That's tip one, just your basic whistleblower carve out to make sure to have that in your documentation. Moving on to tip two, you also want to make sure that the carve out allows for voluntary reporting. Companies have had issues where the carve out only allowed disclosure to the SEC in the event of a subpoena or some other type of compulsory legal process. It should be clear from the language that the employee can voluntarily approach the SEC to report possible securities law violations and isn't bound by needing to be subpoenaed or otherwise, you know, subject to some compulsory legal process, testimony, et cetera. Moving on to tip three, you also want to make sure that you're not improperly limiting the type of confidential information that can be disclosed pursuant to the carve-out. For example, the SEC took issue with a carve-out that provided the employee could only disclose company confidential information that was related to the employee's separation agreement and the circumstances related to entering into the agreement, but not other confidential information the employee may have obtained during employment. Other than certain limited exceptions for a company's ability to maintain the confidentiality of information that an employee obtained through a communication subject to the attorney-client privilege, company confidential information should really generally be viewed as fair game when it comes to an employee reporting a possible securities law violation, and the documents should reflect that.
And beyond that, companies have included other provisions that the SEC has taken issue with too. Can you describe those as well?
Sure, I'll keep going on that one, Meredith. So tip four, there's a typical provision that you see in many release of claim documents where an employee represents that they haven't filed any past charges or complaints against the employer. It's very common, right? Because employers are asking employees often to represent to this as a condition of them receiving severance. They want to know that there are no lingering suits out there. But in two recent enforcement actions, the SEC took issue with this language, essentially seeing it as a required notification to the company after a whistleblower claim was brought, which could disincentivize bringing whistleblower claims to the SEC in the first place. Practically speaking, you want to make sure to carve out in your release of claims that this representation, if you have it, doesn't apply to whistleblower claims. And the employee is not required to make any representation as to whether or not they've brought any whistleblower claims. Moving on to tip 5, the SEC has also come down on a number of companies who have tried to limit the whistleblower's ability to collect a monetary award in connection with a whistleblower claim. Here, the company's thinking is, okay, I know I need to allow the employee to come forward with the whistleblower claim and I can't impede that, but I'm paying them severance or some other kind of separation benefits. I at least want to limit their ability to recover a monetary award from the SEC with respect to that whistleblower claim. And in fact, this is acceptable in other areas of the law. For example, under longstanding EEOC guidance, many of my labor and employment colleagues will tell me that they feel totally comfortable having an employee waive their right to monetary recovery in connection with an EEOC claim, even though they can't legally limit the employee's right to bring the claim in the first place. But the SEC has stated very clearly its position that this is not acceptable when it comes to whistleblower claims. It views the financial incentives for whistleblower claims as an integral part of the program and takes the position that they're just not waivable by contract and that attempting to do so disincentivizes whistleblowers and is against the rule. Tip 6. So we just talked about monetary awards. Now, on the opposite spectrum of monetary awards are monetary penalties. The SEC has pursued enforcement actions against companies who impose monetary penalties on an employee for breaching an overbroad confidentiality provision that would restrict protected whistleblower activity. We like to talk about this internally as a double whammy. Your confidentiality provision was in the first place viewed as too restrictive by the SEC. Maybe it didn't have a good enough whistleblower carve-out. And then on top of that, the company is imposing liquidated damages or other financial penalties for breaching this overbroad provision. And so this whole construct is just problematic, according to the SEC.
So your last 4 tips, I would say, are focused on taking a broad, holistic, and consistent approach to compliance with Rule 21F17. Can you share those tips with us too?
So for tip number 7, you need to look beyond the confidentiality provisions. So for example, you may have a non-disparagement provision or a cooperation provision that could be viewed as problematic by the SEC if it too were overly broad. The SEC charged certain companies for rule violations when their non-disparagement clause specifically were drafted so broadly to impede whistleblowers from communicating with the SEC. It's important, even in that context as well, for the employee to understand they have a right to contact regulators without breaching any non-disparagement clause. Just like Shiri mentioned earlier, one way to achieve this, most simply, is through cross-referencing to a whistleblower carve-out in another provision of the agreement rather than, say, the non-disparagement provision or the cooperation provision. Tip number 8, to ensure internal consistency. Compliant clauses must not be contradicted by other provisions. So again, we need you to look at the agreement as a whole. For example, where a separation agreement might have a carve-out clause, but then it also contains another template clause that requires former employees to notify the company of a request from an administrative agency in connection with a report or a complaint, the inclusion of the latter could be seen as problematic. It undermines the purpose of the whistleblower protection rules that are intended to encourage individuals to report to the SEC. Similar documents that have multiple components can also be a trap for the unwary. The tip at the end of the day is review the document in its entirety. And just because you've complied with, say, some of our first tips of including a carve-out, it's important that your other provisions throughout the document don't contradict or undermine that purpose. Tip number 9, make sure that a whistleblower carve-out in one document is not contradicted by a more restrictive provision in a different document at the same company. Even more holistic, a broader view, it's not just that the agreement itself shouldn't have provisions that are contradictory, but that agreements across the organization shouldn't have any provisions which would undermine the purpose of the carve-out and the rule. So you should think about multiple documents that could apply, especially in a big global company with various subsidiaries, various legal or compliance departments, all of which have different responsibilities. So for best practices, companies should establish ongoing compliance programs with oversight mechanisms to monitor and review agreements and internal policies for provisions that would run afoul of this rule. This should monitor not only for consistently compliant agreements across the organization, but also for any actual retaliation by management or any internal reporting, that sort of wrongdoing that is at the heart of the rule. The goal would be to think broadly about the types of documents to check for compliance across the organization. Ask which company documents restrict voluntary communications with third parties. Which company documents require employees to provide notice to the company when contacted by the government or in connection with an investigation. To list a few, the typical kind of documents that you might want to focus on are, it's a broad range, but really you're obviously your confidentiality agreements are at the forefront, but also your consulting, employment, separation and severance agreements, any releases of claims signed by the company, any employee handbooks or various company policies, for example, your code of conduct, your insider trading policy, finally, the training programs and materials that are provided to your employees. Again, to just be sure that there's nothing that's undermining the ultimate goal of compliance with the rule. And finally, tip number 10, the third-party agreements. Keep in mind that the rule applies to any whistleblowers. For example, the SEC has charged a company with violating the rule by explicitly prohibiting investors from communicating with the SEC in a stock purchase agreement and a settlement agreement. So in our experience, individuals drafting employee-based contracts like employment agreements, employee non-disclosures, or employee separation agreements are more likely to be mindful of these rules for those outside the employment space, such as those drafting limited partnership agreements or stock purchase agreements, don't have these rules at the top of their mind when drafting non-disclosure provisions for investors or acquirers. The goal would be to consider all potential constituencies when drafting and to not just take what we're saying today as applicable to simply your employment agreements, but rather to all the agreements and documents across the organization on the whole.
Mary, that last point is such an important one. I think when people see these new enforcement actions, they think, oh, I need to forward that to my employment colleagues, right? But it's broader than that. So since you surveyed many of these enforcement actions for purposes of preparing these drafting tips, I'm curious if you have any other takeaways or things that surprised folks out of those enforcement actions that our listeners should hear about as well.
This is Sherry Meredith. So we're lawyers, so obviously we have other takeaways. Always have other takeaways here. You just mentioned is one very important takeaway. I think that employment lawyers have this at top of mind, but make sure that within organizations, corporate attorneys and others are really being educated about this so that confidentiality provisions or non-disparagement provisions and other documents that are not typically seen as employee-based agreements are being reviewed for these purposes. Another takeaway is that it's clear from the enforcement actions that an individual doesn't actually have to be impeded from reporting in order for the SEC to charge a company with a Rule 21F17A violation. In many of the actions, the SEC actually made it clear that it had no indication that any individual was actually impeded from whistleblowing activity. But nonetheless, the overly restrictive language in company documentation was considered a serious violation of the rule. For this one, it really is about, in addition to your whistleblower compliance and reporting programs, it really is about poring over your documents, making sure that on their own, on their face, they don't constitute a rule violation.
And hi, this is Mary again. You know, one that I think really surprised some people was that this applies to both private and public companies. We were reminded of that in the recent Monolith cease and desist order. Monolith was a privately held company, and the SEC made clear in the charge that it expects compliance from both public and private companies and will pursue enforcement actions against non-compliant public and private companies. So I think for those of us who counsel both public and private companies and public and private companies themselves, just to be aware that private companies are on the hook for this as well, and the SEC has staked its ground on that.
Right, Mary. And just in addition on that point, I think a lot of times when our colleagues or others that don't practice so much in the public company space see SEC in the headline, they might kind of ignore it or think, oh, that probably doesn't apply to me. But no, this does apply to you too if you counsel private companies or if you are at a private company. And so we just want to make sure that this is spread across as broadly as possible so that folks understand that compliance is necessary across a really broad spectrum. And lastly, I would just say, you know, don't forget that there are other important laws at play when you're crafting agreements such as non-disclosure of confidential information or agreements that contain non-disparagements, right? We often focus in on the issue of the day, but there are lots of issues these days to think about. So for example, there are laws in the wake of Me Too governing what types of claims are not allowed to be subjected to non-disclosure restrictions. There are EEOC rules regarding the ability to report discriminatory actions and preserving that right. There are NLRB positions related to the permitted scope of non-disparagement agreements, and so on and so on. It's really important to think about all of these issues when crafting agreements. And I'll just say at Troutman Pepper, at our firm, it's really a collaborative process where we're working closely with our colleagues in labor and employment, obviously in the SEC enforcement group, but in lots of groups just to ensure that we're providing clients with the most up-to-date advice, because it is truly a constantly and fast evolving legal landscape right now. And there's just a lot to keep up with, even when you're drafting one seemingly short document.
Thank you both so much for taking the time to share your drafting tips and those other takeaways from the enforcement actions. For our listeners, we've been talking about Sherry and Mary's Client Alert Top 10 Tips for Drafting Whistleblower Compliant Arrangements. That is available on thecorporatecouncil.net in our whistleblower practice area and on the Troutman Pepper website. And for even more on this topic, you can watch the hour-long webcast that Sherry and Mary did, and that is available on the Troutman Pepper website. And I loved this program because it was really practical, and they share specific examples of problematic language and then walk through a revised version. So if you are tackling this topic, do check that out. Thank you all for listening, and thanks again, Sherry and Mary.
Thank you.
Thank you so much, Meredith.